welcome folks to this evening here at the First Things offices. As you know, many of you have been regulars with us. It's really a pleasure to be able to use this space to bring in people who can offer some of their expertise and help us think about religion and its role in public life. We also use this space for art exhibitions, and if you look around, we have an automotive theme in our art exhibition here. Well, a fan belt theme, I guess. And we do art openings about 3 or 4 a year. And please come to those; they're a lot of fun, actually. There's more opportunity for drinking and less necessity of listening at an art opening. Well, tonight it's my pleasure to introduce Greg Thornbury, the president of the King's College. And Greg took on the daunting task of first trying to work to understand how Carla Fitzhenry can help guide us towards a renewal of theological culture in the evangelical world. I mean, Carl Henry's such a towering figure in American evangelicalism, and to tackle that, I think, was a necessary and courageous thing to do. I listened to a lecture by Henry when I was a graduate student, and he was an imposing gentleman, I guess, would be the way to think about it. Certainly a man who carried his convictions forcefully and eloquently in a public setting. Great witness to what I would think, a great witness to the objectivity of the gospel, that it's a truth that is real and we have to grapple with it on its terms and not on the terms that we choose. Important for not just for evangelicals, but also for all Christians to think about. But Greg has also taken on the even more daunting task as president of the King's College. We've had King's students come to many of our events. Are we King's students here today? All right, very good, very good. A talented crowd, used to be at the Empire State Building, now downtown. King's is an evangelical institution that wants to sort of bring the spirit of Christ to the urban center, not just of America, but I suppose a kind of global city of New York. And so it's I'm sure it's a tough job to run that college. And we're very grateful that he took it on. It's an important institution here in New York. It's an important institution for Christian witness more broadly. So with that, I'd like to introduce Greg, and welcome to First Things.
Well, thank you, Rusty. It is a great privilege to be here. Upon my arrival in New York City over the summer, one of the first emails, actually, that I got was from Rusty and from David Mills, saying, "Welcome to the neighborhood." And that buoyed me greatly. And shortly thereafter, I had the good fortune of getting to have lunch with Rusty here just down the street. And I was especially thrilled that First Things is in the same building as Tumblr. So I thought that was your street cred really went up a lot, Rusty, when I figured that out. It is a great honor to be here tonight, and I was saying to Morgan earlier, I never assumed that anybody would have any natural interest in any esoteric topic that I would be talking about, especially something like Carl Henry, who was a philosopher, theologian of some renown, as Rusty has said. And I've spoken at a number of different places this year since the book came out this spring on Carl Henry, last week, week before last, I actually spoke at the Evangelical Theological Society, aka Revenge of the Nerds, about Carl Henry, and everybody there would have known who he was. I'm not going to assume that tonight some of you may be know the name but not know much about Henry, and I don't want to try to give a biography, but I want to give something of the elan of his work while we're here tonight. Carl F. H. Henry is a name that a generation ago would have resonated with most Christians across America. In 1976, the famous Year of the Evangelical, Time magazine did that feature story, and they
Newsweek.
But Time magazine did call.
If Ken Woodward were here, he would have yelled out to correct you.
Yes. But Time magazine did call Carl Henry the leading evangelical of the leading theologian of the evangelical movement. But it was the Year of the Evangelical, according to Time magazine. But if Billy Graham was sort of the heart of evangelicalism, Carl Henry was its head. And he was, in a way, sort of the Forrest Gump of American evangelicalism. He was there at the founding of many of the great institutions that are associated with the American evangelical movement. The National Association of Evangelicals, he was in on the founding of that. The Evangelical Theological Society, which I just referenced, Fuller Seminary. I call him the founding editor of Christianity Today, although that is technically not quite true. J. Howard Pugh, because he gave all the money to Christianity Today, was technically the founding editor, but Carl Henry was the first editor of Christianity Today and certainly gave it its esprit de corps. He was the chair of the 1966 World Congress on Evangelism in Berlin. He was involved in the Lausanne movement heavily. He wrote the Statement of Faith for Prison Fellowship, Chuck Colson. And last but not least, he was on the editorial board of First Things, which I know I will sound like a sycophant when I say it, but First Things was what Carl Henry would have wanted Christianity Today to be when it grew up. And this is to say nothing of the kind of impact that Henry had upon evangelical scholarship. Last week when I was participating in a session on Carl Henry, one of the things that Don Carson, the great New Testament scholar, said was that before Henry really came on the scene, there was a real dearth of scholarship from evangelical ranks. You didn't find significant critical commentaries and major systematic theologies. But Henry plowed new ground there as a great philosophical theologian, and now there's a whole cottage industry of that sort of scholarship, so much so that Rupert Murdoch was interested in acquiring Zondervan. So here we are in 2013, the centenary year of Carl Henry's birth. And I've spoken at a number of conferences this year dedicated to Henry's work that have kind of bubbled up as a result and kind of alongside of what I was able to do in my book. I wrote my book as an homage to Henry, who I knew personally, and I'll say a little bit about that toward the end. He was a mentor to me, as a matter of fact. When I got my first academic post at Union University in Tennessee, not long after I had gone there, there was a major EF3 tornado that hit the town in January of 1999. The first phone call that we got of concern was from Carl and Helga Henry, calling from Watertown, Wisconsin. So I wrote it to discharge a debt, but honestly, I was overwhelmed by the interest in a book on Carl Henry in 2013, and for that I am very grateful, and especially grateful for First Things running the very generous review of the book by Bruce Ashford. My book, Recovering Classic Evangelicalism, was primarily designed to show how Henry's shaping influence on evangelicalism as its defining theologian took place through his thought. So it's not a biography, but it's more about his thought. And he had wrote over 40 books, but had his two signal contributions would have been The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism, published in 1948, and his magisterial six-volume work, God, Revelation, and Authority, which Millard Erickson once said to me, the great evangelical theologian, Millard Erickson once said to me, next time you see Carl Henry, say hello to him. I love him very much. I just can't wait for God, Revelation, and Authority to be translated into English. So much of it is very heady reading and very slow going, but it did supply intellectual heft to the evangelical movement, and gave it his animating ideas gave evangelicalism a certain esprit de corps. Now, since Carl Henry died in 2003, it's been kind of a bit of a blood sport in evangelicalism to dissect Henry's work, to criticize it, to say that there's nothing more square or yesteryear in recent evangelical scholarship than talking about Carl Henry. And yet, so many of his ideas in those framing institutions and his published work were defining ideas. So I say in the book that as I approached writing it, I sort of felt like Frodo taking the ring to Mordor and wondering if the Shire would be there when I got back and what condition it would be in. And I was reminded of a Henrician theme several weeks ago when I was listening to a talk by Robert Hammond, who was one of the men largely responsible for the High Line here in New York City, which we all know and love. But he said that the fundamental concept of design that has to prevail for good design is that for things to change, everything must stay the same. In order for things to change, everything must stay the same. And that's the way I would describe Henry's theological work. He genuinely believed that to meet the challenges of the modern world, everything must stay rooted in the revelatory pattern of Scripture. And if anything, he was adamant that evangelicals in particular, which was his tribe, recover their ability to engage in a theory of knowledge, in epistemology. So he was the anti-Theodore Adorno, who wrote against epistemology. God, Revelation, and Authority is pro-epistemology. So if the zeitgeist of much of contemporary evangelicalism is what we have to change in order to meet the challenges of our current time, Henry would have said we need to go back to the sources that make the movement special and gave evangelicalism its sort of framing devices. Now, the title of my book is Recovering Classic Evangelicalism, and some of that is a bit tongue-in-cheek, but what do I mean by classic evangelicalism? Well, there is a little bit of nostalgia in this, and I'm happy to admit that. Part of what I'm referring to goes back to a time in, especially in the 1960s and early 1970s, when the individuals who characterized the evangelical movement were people like Billy Graham, who was engaging the masses through his crusades. Francis Schaeffer was drawing hippies and artists and musicians and young intellectuals to LaBrie. And whatever you think of Frankie Schaeffer, you definitely need to read Crazy for God. Because it is a rather amazing thing that Jimmy Page would have handed a copy of Escaped from Reason to Eric Clapton and say, this is the best book I'm reading right now. Then you had, my next project is to write a biography of Larry Norman, who is kind of the poet laureate of the Jesus movement, a musician. He was on Capitol Records, MGM Records. He was being produced by George Martin, the Beatles producer. He was opening up on tour for Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and Van Morrison and preaching about Jesus on stage, and then, you know, then Janis Joplin would come out and everybody would forget about Jesus. And then you had Carl Henry was editing Christianity Today at its zenith. And classic evangelicalism was upbeat, it was confident, it was engaged, it was known more by what it was for rather than what it was against. It was an attitude that because God speaks in intelligible sentences and paragraphs, which is a phrase that Henry loved to use, through the verities of divine revelation, we can speak convictionally about the foundations of the faith to the world in which we live. And they had these classic evangelicals had a buoyant commentator, Colin Brown and Millard Erickson, not to mention biblical studies giants without Henry as a precursor. And the same thing is doubly true for Francis Schaeffer, who borrowed liberally from Henry and Van Til without much attribution. Henry understood that the greatest threat to world evangelization was secular ideology. And so in the final passage of his Remaking the Modern Mind, he said this, quote, "The modern ideology needs to be remade. That is admitted today by those who have shaped it as well as those who have opposed it. But its effective remaking can be accomplished only in a philosophical framework in which rebirth is something more than a change in human temperament, in which indeed it is a divine reversal, a work of regeneration. If the modern mind is not reborn, but merely exchanges one mood for another, we stand only a generation away from the fruit of atheism, the pessimism of despair." And as I've done interviews on Carl Henry this year, I'm often asked, what is the kind of one takeaway from Carl Henry? And actually, I think it is this. There's a difference between faith and ideology. There's something about the gospel that is truly transcendent of all times and all places and all situations. Christianity is not just another ideology. And there's actually a fascinating passage in a subsequent book from 1948, his follow-up to The Uneasy Conscience, called The Protestant Dilemma, in which he talks about the Protestant church as it faces its dilemma after World War II. He saw for a moment to speak into to that culture, humanity's lostness, the rise of authoritarianism and totalitarianism. He said there was this mood of anticipation to hear something that was really, really true. And at this point, he goes back to where in history could we go back to as a model for a great idea that could shape a mythology or whatever that could shape an entire culture. And he goes to Plato's Republic. And here I'd like to quote him a bit at length. He says, "A similar longing is found at a high point in Plato's Republic. The great Greek thinker, foreseeing that the prevailing moral instability would lead to the downfall of the nation, urges his contemporaries to become explicit about the spiritual moral universe. Plato then proposes an outline for an ideal state which will function with reference to an eternal good, an eternal truth, and an eternal beauty. At this point, a very practical question arises. How are the multitudes to be prevailed upon to undertake the change from the old world to the new, old world order to the new? What compelling sanction can be appealed to that the people will dedicate themselves to in their proper roles?" Plato's answer is the one royal lie. And here he quotes the Republic at length. Well then, I will speak, although I really know not how to look you in the face or in what words to utter this audacious fiction, which I propose to communicate gradually, first to the rulers, then to the soldiers, and lastly to the people. They are to be told that their youth was a dream, and that education and training which they received from us was in appearance only. In reality, all that time they were being formed and fed in the womb of the earth, where they themselves and their arms and appurtenances were manufactured. When they were completed, the earth, their mother, sent them up. And so, their country being their mother and their nurse, they are bound to advise for her good and to defend her against attacks. And her citizens, they are to regard as children of the earth and their own brothers, citizens. We shall say to them in our tale, you are brothers, yet God has framed you differently. Some of you have the power to command, others to be auxiliaries, others to be husbandmen and craftsmen. And God proclaims as a first principle to the rulers, and above all else, that there is nothing which they should so anxiously guard, or of which they are to be such good guardians as of the purity of the race. Such is our tale. Is there any chance of making our citizens believe it? And Henry follows up on this with this comment. For all its brilliance, there is no more pathetic moment in Plato's Republic. For here Plato, who would have been the last to concede that an eternal spiritual moral realm was merely a postulation of his own mind, would nonetheless ride the conviction into the hearts of the multitudes by anchoring it to mythology, unquote. Henry says, Plato, he's the best case scenario, right, of the ancient philosophers. Justin Martyr and Origen and Clement of Alexandria believe this, certainly. They didn't know of Aristotle, so we could argue about that later. But it was interesting, as I went a couple of weeks ago to the premiere of Slavoj Žižek's new film, The Pervert's Guide to Ideology. And Žižek was himself there to do questions and answers afterwards. It was kind of like the philosophical equivalent of seeing Bono. It was a big deal. But it was interesting at the pinnacle of Žižek's movie, he's making this point that everything is pure ideology. He's advancing Lacan's point that the big other is not there. There is nothing behind the symbolic realm. It's a void. And where does he go to establish this point? He goes to precisely this moment in Plato's Republic that Henry cites here. See, God's not out there. There is nothing out there. It is just a void. We are alone. To close my thoughts here with you tonight, I do have a personal angle to the story about Carl Henry that I would like to share in closing. Carl Henry has, for me, been something like my own Saint Anthony. He's been the patron saint of lost things for me. In my freshman year of college, I had a really wonderful articulate, Oxford-trained New Testament professor who was a brand new professor at Messiah College where I went, and had us reading Marcus J. Borg, Jesus, A New Vision, as our introductory New Testament textbook, and we were reading things from the Jesus Seminar, and I don't know if this was intent, but my faith was rattled, because my belief in the Bible as a supernatural work of divine revelation was really tested. And I grew up in a godly home. My father was a faithful pastor in just outside of Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, scholar in his own right. He was concerned. And we would have phone conversations, and he would give me things to read, and I would, you know, knock them down. And he finally went for the nuclear option. He said, son, he said, I want you to go to the library and I want you to go find these books called God, Revelation, and Authority by Carl F. H. Henry. And I remember going down into the bowels of the Murray Learning Resources Center at Messiah, having a fellow alum here, and plucking those volumes off the shelf and sitting there with them in the library floor. And as I read those pages, here was a scholar of a titanic intellect, educated in philosophy at Boston University. And I couldn't understand everything that he was saying. It was like reading German thought. But I could understand enough of it to realize that what was happening is that my faith was beginning to rally. And so, humanly speaking, I owe that recovery of my own faith to Carl F. H. Henry, which I was able to express to him at a later time. Carl Henry pulled me back from the brink at a time when I needed it most. And so over the years, I have found myself talking to undergraduate students who, like me at that time, have been shaken or rattled. And I have found that I had a worthy mentor and model in that recovery project. Thank you so much for coming tonight, and I very, very much appreciate being here. Thank you.